Yes, I love it.
Sweet, he's giving me 300 boxes of Grape Nuts Flakes.
Friends anybody ever had. And it's funny, but I feel as if I've known you all the time.
I love music, good music, but not swing. I sing.
Hi, and welcome to the Movie Magic Podcast. Each week, we will dive into a certain star and talk to some people who know much about him. I'm Kate, your host, and welcome to the Movie Magic Podcast. Hope you enjoy it. Hi, and welcome to the Movie Magic Podcast. Today's episode is Norma Shearer, and I talk with Darren Barnes, an expert on Norma Shearer.
So, well, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast. I'm so deeply excited. I mean, I love Norma Shearer, but I know nothing about her. So, I'm so excited for you to come on the podcast and just talk about her. I'm so excited.
Well, you've come to the right place. You know, ask me anything you want, and I could pretty much answer it.
Okay, wonderful. So, as I usually start my podcast, usually I give a little bit of our listeners a little bit of backstory on them, like when they were born, where they were born, a little bit of their childhood. So if you could tell me a little bit about when and where she was born and a little bit of her childhood.
Yeah, so she was born in 1902 in Montreal. So she's Canadian.
Mm.
Yeah, so she grew up there and left when she was 18.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she had a pretty idyllic childhood for the most part. Her mm-hmm. father did go broke, and, you know, they did have money issues in the family. But for the most part, she had a very loving mother, and she had her older brother, Doug, mm-hmm. Douglas Shearer, who was the head of the sound department at MGM.
Mm.
And she had an older sister, a foal, which it's taken me years to find out that a foal, H-E-H-O-L-E, is actually pronounced Ethel.
Yeah. I always thought it was like Atoll or something, or Atoll or something. I never knew how to pronounce her sister's name.
Yeah, well, and I finally found somebody, Douglas Shearer's youngest son, Mark, is still alive. He's 83.
Oh.
And so he was there, so I got to ask him, I'm like, how do you pronounce her name? And he's like, it's Ethel.
Ethel, huh.
So it's almost like Ethel, but uh-huh. like a tiny little accent on it. Nobody has any idea where that name came from.
Huh.
So she lived in Montreal, had a pretty amazing childhood, and moved to New York in 1920. Was there for about 9 months, did really well, and then didn't do well. Went back to Montreal, then went back to New York, and 1921, 22, 23, she really took off in a movie career. So, you know, it's an amazing life.
Mm-hmm. So, how did she come to Hollywood? Who discovered her?
Well, she was, there was actually an agent named Edward Small,
mm-hmm.
and I've been doing a lot of homework on him. So, he was a big agent in New York. He actually also discovered Mary Carlisle, who was at the Motion Picture Country Home.
Oh.
Yeah, and he discovered a lot of these people and really fostered their careers. So she stumbled into his office around 1921,
mm-hmm.
and he really got behind her and got her into all of these movies early on. So she was just, you know, a working actress, and was approached by Metro Pictures, which was Louis B. Mayer, and signed to a contract in April of 1923.
Mm-hmm. Because I know she did extra work for a little while.
Yeah, that was, so when she and her sister and her mother went to New York the first time in 1920,
mm-hmm.
They did extra work. That's when she did The Flapper,
mm-hmm.
which was their very first movie, and it's there's restored copies of it that are around, and it's pretty amazing to see Norma at 18 and her first movie being smart enough to know that she needed to stand next to the star of the movie in every scene that she's in.
Yeah.
You know, you watch her, she really stands out, but she really makes a point of it without being obnoxious.
Absolutely. And I heard, maybe you might correct me on this, but I heard, because I love Olive Thomas and I have like a documentary, that either it was her or her sister that got sick and Olive quietly paid their bills until they could find work again.
Yeah, they were on location in Mount Vernon,
mm-hmm.
shooting some scenes in the snow,
mm-hmm.
and they had a bunch of extras, a foal being one of them, in a a sled accident, and she went into the hospital, and Olive actually paid her hospital bills and sent her notes and checked in on her and was just incredibly nice to her.
Of course. Olive being the world's greatest sweetheart, from my understanding.
Yeah, she's supposed to have been an incredible lady.
Yes, as far as I know. I mean, that's she. I've done some research on Olive Thomas. I went to go see her grave in 2013, and you know, I just had like just a great experience just researching Olive, just saying that she quietly paid somebody's bills, you know, without even meaning to really. She was just like, you know what, you're not doing very well. Let me chip in, because I know that you're just extras right now. Let me chip in and let me help. So. Yeah. So that's good. So what was Norma's first movie that she had a starring role in?
I think we'll look at her filmography really quick. The Wunters was one that got a lot of early interest on her, which was 1920. And then she did, A Clouded Name. There was a lot of early ones that really, you know, the reviews for him would be bad, but they'd always say, all the reviews will always point her out, say, like, this girl's got promise, like, she's got promise. Like, it's amazing when I'm going back and reading all the reviews of her, especially at her silent work, like, they just loved her early on. So The Steelers was the one that kind of got her first notices. That was a supporting part in 1920. She really felt like that was the movie that she's like, I'm set now. And nothing really came out of it. So that's when she went back to Toronto and then came back. And then she did The Leather Pushers, which I've actually seen. And it was a 10-part boxing series with Reginald Denny.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And she's the series itself, is, I think, like 5 episodes. I actually went to the Eastman Kodak House to watch a print of it. And even without music, it was really good. So, and she's really good in it, but Channing of the Northwest, The Bootleggers, A Clouded Name, like these, all these pictures, Pleasure Mad was probably the one that she really started to get like notices for around 1923. But that was when her career really kind of kicked into the next gear, because she had Lucretia Lombard, The Wunters, Pleasure Mad, Wolfman, and you know, great reviews, all did really well at the box office. And you know, by 23, 24, she was, like, you know, really making a name.
And when she made He Who Gets Slapped, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. When was that made?
So that's made in 24.
Okay.
So she came out here in April, came out to Hollywood in April of 23, and MGM was still being formed. So Louis B. Mayer really didn't have anything for her, so they started loaning her out. So all of those early films that she did here, Wunters, Pleasure Mad, Lucretia Lombard, all those are all for other studios.
So oh, wow.
When Metro finally formed, they put together He Who Gets Slapped, which was the very first production that was completely conceived and produced at MGM. So, and I always feel like that really shows what they felt about Norma, that they're going to put their three biggest stars in their first film that's conceived from beginning to end.
Yes, it's because it's is it John Gilbert?
Yes, John Gilbert and Lon Chaney.
Lon Chaney, right. Lon Chaney Sr. So it's great movie. I've seen it. It's she does really well. And I actually really like, you know, I'll be blunt with you, I haven't seen all of her movies, but I have seen a fair chunk of them. And what I've seen, especially her silent work, I do enjoy very much. And especially He Who Gets Slapped is a really good movie. TCM will show it every now and then. So it's a really good movie. And, you know, and Lon Chaney is absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's a very dark film, but it's a really good film. So, and it still holds up almost 100 years later.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
yeah, I mean, you should definitely see Lady of the Night, which is available on Warner Home Video, and TCM does show that once in a while. And that's 1925, and that's Norma, you know, playing a good girl and a bad girl part. That's the one where Joan Crawford plays Norma's double.
Oh, that's right. I did hear about that, but I didn't know if that was true or not.
Oh, it's true, and Lady of the Night is, it's really solid, good movie. So, and she did one with Jack Pickford, Waking Up the Town. So, you know, and you know, at that point, that's when Norma was becoming very friendly with Mary Pickford, mm-hmm. and she had made the movie. And I've always wondered, like, did she meet Jack Pickford, you know, during a flapper, even just casually because of Olive Thomas? But, mm-hmm. you know, I've never been able to substantiate that. She's never mentioned it anywhere.
Right. Because I know Olive was married to Jack at one point in time.
Yeah, and I think they were married at that point, or mm-hmm. at least going together.
Yeah, they were married, like, in 1917, 18, one of those years. And they were married up, and they were kind of, like, they were kind of on the rocks for a little bit. And then they went to Paris, and then that's when all hell broke loose, really, in 1920. So, and of course, you know, they didn't really have anything to help her, because, you know, it was killing her, whatever, you know, the poison was killing her. So they didn't really have anything. But I know that Norma and Mary, I know they had some pictures done together, but I don't know if I've ever seen any, like, not movies, but I know they had, like, photos together.
Yeah, well, they were very friendly socially, like, a lot.
Oh.
So, and I've got pictures of them up and through, like, the early 50s at events and parties together.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and it isn't like they were just crossing paths at a premiere or an event. They would go together.
Oh, so, that's awesome.
Yeah, which I've always felt was kind of socially awkward, because Norma was also really good friends with Sylvia Ashley Fairbanks, the second wife.
Oh, God.
And how do you go out with the new wife one night and then go out with the ex-wife the next night to an event?
Right? How do you do that? I guess she was like, well, might as well do it for the clout, because, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like, might as well go for it.
Well, and I figured, you know, and those ladies knew their brand. You know, they knew, you know, now we have social media. Back then they didn't, mm-hmm. so they needed to go out.
Right.
And, you know, Norma knew she was with Mary, she was going to get photographed. Mary knew she was with Norma, she was going to get photographed. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of their version of social media, you know, back in the day. And, you know, I'm researching and putting together a book on Norma.
Oh!
And, which has been fantastic. I've learned so much more about her.
That's wonderful. Because you bring up that, and we'll actually get into that a little bit later, because I do have some questions about that for you.
Okay.
Another thing I want to ask is, how did she meet Irving Thalberg? Let's get into that, because that was like her first marriage, was it not?
Yeah, that was her first marriage, and supposedly, you know, from everything I've read, from her autobiography, from every article, he was fascinated with her, and he at least saw her star quality mm-hmm. as early as 1923. Mm-hmm. And he was the one that was actually behind Louis B. Mayer signing Norma to Metro, because he was leaving Universal and on his way over to Metro, and was like, you need to sign this girl. So, you know, he was Universal for a little bit. They mm-hmm. tried to get her. He tried to get her a couple of times wherever he was working, and then finally got her in at MGM. Mm-hmm. And then it seemed like they had a very friendly, cordial friendship with each other, at least 25, 26. And, you know, Norma was dating other people. He was dating other people. Mm-hmm. And then they just sort of came together by the mid, early 1926, and then, you know, married in September 27. And as much as you may ever hear or read about it being a marriage of convenience, or she married the boss, or mm-hmm. all of those things you hear, you know, all of the research I've done on it, all of the paperwork, all of the telegrams between the two of them, whenever Irving would travel to New York, or she would travel and they weren't together, at every stop, he would send her a telegram, I love you, I miss you so much. And at the next stop, there would be a telegram waiting from her saying, I got your telegram, I love you, I miss you so much. And they were so sweet. And if you're just married for image, you don't need to do that kind of stuff.
Right. So they really, like, I know he really loved her very much.
Yeah. You know, and I think he, you know, they really admired each other, mm-hmm. You know, just professionally. And I think they really did love each other. And mm-hmm. he was very much of an artist producer. You know, he really mm-hmm. respected artists and understood their quirkiness.
Yeah.
And, you know, absolutely. And I think what little quirks Norma had, he probably just embraced.
Yeah, that's from my understanding, because I know when Lillian Gish started at MGM, Irving Thalberg was kind of the driving force behind some of her movies. I know she had said that he was the driving force behind, I think, The Scarlet Letter. If it wasn't for Irving Thalberg, there would be no Scarlet Letter. So, because Louis B. Mayer did not want to do it. And he was like, I don't think I should do it. And Gish was like, you know, I really want to do this project. I'm very, like, passionate about it. And Irving was like, listen, I'll fund it. Like, you want to make it? I'll fund it. Like, I'll start a GoFundMe or whatever. I'll do whatever it takes to do it. And it was made, and it did really well at the box office. And Louis B. Mayer's like, oh, Irving, you did a good job. Like, give him a big pat on the back. And he's like, see, I told you. Like, if you listen to me every now and then, we can make great movies. And because of Irving Thalberg, like, there were a lot of great movies that were made at MGM.
Oh, yeah. He definitely set the bar for MGM, you know, mm-hmm. as high as MGM was. And, mm-hmm. you know, he really, for his artistic taste, and, you know, he also just respected talent so much, and he would mm-hmm. put up with, you know, George Harrell had a lot of issues and was very dramatic and would storm out, and, you know, Irving would always put up with it, and mm-hmm. he had writers and producers and directors and talent that were basically just batshit crazy.
Yeah.
But he totally understood it, and Mayer just did not put up with that. He did not like it. He was like, you're out, it's my way or the highway kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and it's kind of sad because if you watch, you know, MGM up until 1936, 37, because
mm-hmm.
Irving passed away in 36,
mm-hmm.
that's all like, that's just Irving driven. That's like, you know, Grand Hotel, it's all those great, great movies.
Yes.
And then for the few years after that, those were all producers that were trained under Irving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mervyn LeRoy came over and did like Wizard of Oz. You know, Gone with the Wind wasn't an MGM film, it was Selznick. So, mm-hmm. you know, they're sort of like high, their bar of just absolute quality
mm-hmm.
just sort of, you know, it sort of dissipates over the years. And you can just see it just sort of slowly going down.
Absolutely, because after Thalberg died, you know, it wasn't too much longer until Pasternak came and replaced him at MGM.
Yeah.
And Pasternak, you know, he tried to replicate what he did at Universal, you know, trying to make, like, all these great singers and everything, these great musicals. Great. You know, I'm not saying that they weren't, you know, that they weren't terrible. But you can't, you know, you can't have multiple Deanna Durbins, Pasternak. I mean, you could try, but, I mean, I know he definitely backed, like, Catherine Grayson and Jean Allison. I mean, that's great. I mean, after, I'm sure they were, like, after Norma's time, because Norma retired, like, in
42,
right. Like, she was at the height of her career when she retired, which we'll get into in a moment, because I do want to get to her family life with Thurl Thalberg, because she had two children with him, didn't she?
Yeah, she had a boy and a girl.
Boy and a girl. And were you able to talk to them?
No. So she had Irving Jr. in 1930,
mm-hmm.
which I really consider Norma's, like, pinnacle year for her career, because
mm-hmm.
you figure she got the divorcee, she got an Oscar,
mm-hmm.
she had the Crown Prince of Hollywood, Irving mm-hmm. Thalberg Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, what an incredible year for her.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, coming from, you know, where she had come from and being a struggling actress to suddenly being, you know, this person at MGM, and then being that respected on the Hollywood stage,
mm-hmm.
you know, 30 was like the year for her.
Mm-hmm.
And Irving Jr. passed away in 1987.
Oh.
So, yeah, and he's got, he was married to his first wife. They had some children together.
Mm-hmm.
And then they divorced in, like, 1969, 1970.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Suzanne, his first wife, basically took the kids and they moved to another city. So they ended up being kind of the kids of, like, another family.
Oh,
and
okay.
So they, you know, Deborah Thalberg only met Norma once, just in passing. Like, they didn't really have any time with their grandmother.
No.
So, yeah, and then Suzanne, Catherine,
mm-hmm.
which everybody called her Katie, she was born in 1935.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she was born in June of 35, and Irving died in August of 36.
Oh,
so,
she was only a year when he died.
Yeah, so, she, you know, I'm sure she didn't have any memories of her family, or of her father.
Mm-hmm.
And she had multiple kids, and she ended up in Aspen, Colorado, and she passed away, like 10 years ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
And she was never really open to speaking to anybody, you know, mm-hmm. but I also wonder, did anybody ever actually approach her? Because
mm-hmm.
I've never really seen anybody or read of anybody actually trying to approach her.
Oh, okay. I always wondered. Because I've tried to reach out to her grandkids from Catherine, and they never responded. So either, but I've also heard that they disliked their grandmother for some reason. Do you know anything about that?
Well, you know, I think
I don't think they disliked her. I think they just weren't ever close to her. Mm. You know, and that's, you know, it's being the child and being the grandchild of a movie star has got to be really tough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you'll have those, like, Janet Leigh exceptions, you know, where there are, you know, even like a Debbie Reynolds, you know, mm-hmm. you'll have those exceptions where they really make a lot of time for their kids. But from, you know, everything I've ever read, like, you know, both of Norma's kids were always away at school. Mm-hmm. You know, Irving Jr. went to military school, and Catherine went to school in, I think she went to school in Switzerland, she went to school in Paris, she went to school here, so she was always away. So they were, you know, as I've heard many times, just raised by other people.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Norma, Catherine's children are with Richard Anderson, the actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Norma adored Richard Anderson, so I have a feeling she probably went over to the house to see Catherine and Richard and the kids, to see Richard.
Mm-hmm.
but yeah, those kids, the kids on that end, just, you know, I've reached out multiple times. They don't really have anything to really say or contribute, and, you know, I don't think it even really had much of an exchange with her.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
I've always wondered, yeah. Yeah, I try to reach out to, like, people's kids and grandkids as much as I can. And you would be surprised by the responses I get. Is, you know, recently it was Priscilla Lane's family. And Priscilla Lane's family is wonderful. You know, I've heard from 3 of her 4 kids. They are terrific. And I heard from a granddaughter. Well, I remember posting something on Instagram about, you know, me reaching out to Priscilla's family. Well, her granddaughter saw it and commented and said, "Hey, well, I'm her granddaughter. I'm happy to help if you need anything." And I'm like, "Oh my God." You know what? Wonderful things. But there are a lot of responses that I get that are, you know, they don't respond at all. So it's either, you know, it's like Deanna Durbin's kids, you know, they don't want to talk about her, obviously. I have heard from a stepdaughter, and she said that, you know, her kids are lovely people. It's just that, you know, they don't like talking about her. And I'm just like, okay, so that kind of raises a lot of questions. Like, what did she do that was so bad that they don't want to talk about it? Or maybe it's just that she just didn't want to talk about her career, period. I don't know. But, you know, I guess with Norma's family, it's kind of hard, because especially when you're writing this book, I always wondered, like, if the family would have any say in it. You know what I mean?
No, I wish they would. So, mm-hmm. Suzanne Irving's first wife, you know, mm-hmm. she was there from, they got married 56 or 57. So, mm-hmm. and she knew Norma, you know, she would see her, you know, as her mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And she has lots and lots of wonderful firsthand stories about Norma
mm-hmm.
that, you know, I'll be able to include that are, you know, they're not intrusive, because I don't want to be intrusive, and I'm mm-hmm. not here to dig up, like, dirt. You know,
right.
That's not my thing. It's like when Mickey Rooney did that biography, and I think he literally said he and Norma had that affair just so he could sell mm-hmm. books.
Right. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Oh, Mickey Rooney's a piece of dirt anyway. I wouldn't go by what anything.
No, he totally does. But, you know, I think it's like anything. You know, everybody has a different relationship with their parents and their grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it just depends on where it sort of falls in the spectrum, because there's, like, the McCrae kids, you know, they mm-hmm. love Frances D and Joel McCrae. They take care of the family ranch still.
Mm.
So, you know, they really foster the whole legacy of the McCrae family, and I love that. And you can just tell that that's the way that they were raised.
Yeah, and it's kind of like with Priscilla Lane's family as well, because they weren't raised around Hollywood at all, because she had retired afterwards. Like, by the time that she had the kids, like, she had kind of retired and was like, okay, I'm done, I just want to be a mom. And she, you know, and she rarely did interviews and stuff like that, but she still got fan mail, you know. So her kids are kind of like, mom was an actress for some time, this is how she got in it, and this is what she did, and this is my mom. But she was always mom to me. So I think that's what her kids are probably thinking, you know, because I don't know if anybody's ever asked Catherine or Irving Jr. that about their mom, because, you know, from my understanding, you know, they were probably just, you know, she's just mom, you know?
Yeah. I think that really is, you know, just the difference in their relationships. And Norma was a movie star till the day she died. You know, she was always the one to, you know, Suzanne would tell me about, you know, they would go to parties or events or dinners or whatever with mm-hmm. Irving Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And as they were, the three of them would go to walk in the door, Norma would always, like, pause for a second, like, oh, let me get something out of my purse, or let me do this, or let me do that. So they would go ahead, and she would always walk in and make a present. which I love. So, you know, she wouldn't walk in as part of the group. And Suzanne said, you know, they didn't go to a lot of things together, but they'd even go to, like, a restaurant together. Mm-hmm. And Norma would always do this sort of, like, little pause, and then mm-hmm. she would become Norma and walk in behind them, and, like, all the heads would turn, even if people didn't know who she was.
Right. Absolutely. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I love that star power, and yeah, I've seen those actresses do it. They still do it. You know, I met Virginia Mayo once. And
oh, really?
She literally just, you know, she was towards the end of her life, and she was just sitting in a wheelchair and kind of wilted, and I started to talk to her, and you just see all of a sudden, like, 40 years just came off her face, and she became Virginia Mayo for, like, 20 minutes, and then she kind of went back into her bubble.
Yeah, and you know Cora Sue Collins like I do, so it's, you know,
oh my God.
We know people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because my friend Gloria Jean, who was an actress in the 40s, I knew her for 3 years, and she had mentioned Norma. I don't know if she ever met Norma Shearer, but she always said that, "Have you watched Norma Shearer?" I was like, "Yes." She goes, "Okay, have you seen The Women?" "Yes." "Okay. It's a pivotal movie. If you haven't seen it, you got to see it."
I think I might actually have a photo of them together at a War Bond Drive.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'll have to find it.
Oh, wow. Because I remember her mentioning something like she either met Norma or she met her in passing. But it was kind of like it was an interesting thing where certain stars would meet and they don't know why they would meet, but they would just meet up and be like, "Oh, hey, we're here. Oh, you're here too. Oh, wonderful. What are you doing? Oh, I'm just here. I'm just here for the publicity. Me too. I'm ready to get that paycheck."
Oh yeah, like they would just go do those premieres, and that's been the great thing I've been researching. And I always kind of wondered, like, when they would do a premiere in the golden age, and they mm-hmm. would have those big crowds out front, you know,
yeah,
social media, you just kind of put it out there.
Right.
But they would put it in the paper for a week building up to it.
Right.
And they'd say, like, we're going to have the champ on this Thursday at this theater, and here are the 12 stars that have all said they're going to go. And every day it would say, like, you know, come buy tickets, this is who's going to be here. And then literally the morning of, because there used to be morning and evening issues, they would be like, come to the movie tonight, you know, come buy your ticket. You could actually buy a ticket to sit in the audience, quote, but with the celebrities, although they never stayed for the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could always confirm whether Norma went or not, because they would talk about what she wore to the post party.
Wow. Because Norma Shearer just seemed like she was the life of the party.
Oh, my God. And she was out, like, 3 or 4 nights a week. I mean, it just seemed like for her entire career, even after she retired, she was constantly at something or doing something.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, Jimmy Stewart, I've got some great quotes from him, because they dated for, you know, a few months. And he said that, you know, he didn't want to feel like he was a possession. But he had to admit that he was with Norma, he had a really good time.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think like, with Norma Shearer, just her name just in general is just like this powerhouse.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So getting to The Women, speaking of The Women, what was, because I've heard stories about how her and Joan Crawford didn't get along. What was their relationship like?
You know what? The more that I've investigated it, there was, you know, there is the resentment of Norma being married to Boss.
That's uh-huh.
completely understandable.
Mm-hmm.
But they both respected each other.
Mm-hmm.
They also knew the power of publicity.
Mm.
And a feud is great for publicity.
Mm.
So, you know, up until The Women, there wasn't really a whole lot ever said about the rivalry. You know, there would be mentions of, you know, Norma got this role that Joan wanted kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
MGM never played up a rivalry between them. She's basically just another actress on the lot.
Mm.
So when The Women came around, you know, they put them on the cover of Look magazine and said they don't like each other was the headline.
Mm.
So, and what's better to keep perpetuating it than always, you know, going on about, you know, we have this rivalry. But in Norma's autobiography, she actually talks about it quite a bit and just says, you know, I really like Joan, but mm-hmm. I could always see behind those great big blue eyes of hers that she would never trust me.
Mm.
And there's a picture of them, a famous one in the 50s, of them hugging at a party. And, you know, I've got them at events together, you know, being cordial with each other through mm-hmm. the 30s, 40s, and into the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think, you know, they weren't going to sit down and write each other letters or anything, but I think they respected each other, and, you know, I'm sure that Norma respected Joan for her just absolute, you know, cunningness in her career. And it had to have been, you know, it's brutal now, but it had to have been brutal then to be with the competition. And, you know, as I'm getting into these newspapers even more, by the way, so late 30s, they're talking about Norma's age a lot. And it's really crappy. You know, I keep saying, well, God, you know, the old timers are still around. You know, here's a list of the actors and actresses who are still working, who, you know, were working in 1920. And they put it at the top of the list, and they were always sort of insinuating, like, when are the old timers going to give it up? So it's pretty brutal. But, you know, I think they were just, you know, they respected each other. And I think, you know, it's just, it's good for publicity.
Okay. Because I know, because they worked in The Women together, you know, and they played off really well together.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, you know, and Joan Crawford being kind of like this actress who kind of came up from nothing, really. She was started in the 20s as well as an extra. Yeah. She got her big break, I guess, or whatever. She was doing silent pictures. And then she does sound. And, you know, and then she gets teamed up with Norma. I think they worked together twice, right? Or is it more?
Well, they did the silent one, you know, where Joan was just her double, and then they did just The Women.
Okay.
And, you know, and for The Women, you know, Norma had just come out of Marie Antoinette, and she was talked into doing The Women. Like, The Women had never really been considered a movie for her, but Louis B. Mayer did talk her into doing it, which, you know, I'm glad, because it is the one film that she's remembered the most for.
Yes.
And it's, you know, as much as we love Divorcée and Marie Antoinette and the rest of them, it's still the ones. You know, it's such a crowd pleaser. And, you know, Joan's career had been in trouble for a couple of years. Like, she was sort of floundering a bit. So she needed a big movie like this, even the second. It's such a showy role. You know, everybody loves her in the movie.
Oh, absolutely. I think when I was 8 years old, that's the first time I ever saw Norma Shearer on the screen. And we watched The Women. And, of course, The Women has been redone twice. And I don't think I like, you know, The Opposite Sex, which is the musical version of the, well, not the musical version, but it's the colorized version of The Women.
Yeah.
With Joan Collins and Ann Miller and Joan Blondell is good. It's cute, but it's not Norma Shearer. It's not Paulette Goddard. It's not Joan Fontaine. It's not Virginia Wilder. You know, it's not them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they try to make it as good as possible, which is great. But it's not The Women, you know? You kind of miss Joan.
The crazy thing about that movie that I always love is that June Allison was, like, a singing star and then retired and becomes Mrs. Stephen Haynes and then goes back to work.
Yeah.
And they dubbed her voice for all of her singing numbers.
Which I thought was hilarious when I read that, and I was like, oh,
yeah, like, she's been on screen for like 12 years at that point. We all knew what June Allison sounds like when she sings.
Yeah, and I'm like, well, I guess they just didn't think it was up to par.
Yeah, but no, you know, the Women was, you know, a huge hit for Norma. It was, you know, really well received. And like 6 days after they wrapped that movie, she got on the train and went to New York and could not get further away from that movie. She didn't go to the premiere. She didn't do any press for it. She was gone. When they had the premiere, she was on her way to Europe.
Yeah.
Like, she just never looked back on that movie.
She was like, peace out, homies.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. Like, she's like, I am out of here.
Bye.
Yeah, she went to a couple of events wearing costumes from the movie, like, a week after, and then got on a train and just left.
She just said, peace out, bye?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Did she take her kids, at least?
No, left them here.
Oh,
she went to New York and was going to go on to Paris with Charles Boyer and his wife, and that's when she met George Raft. And then she started that year-long playing.
Because, she was married how many times?
Just twice. So, she was married to Irving for 9 years. He passed away in 1936, and then she married her second husband, Marty, in August of 1942, and stayed married to him until she passed away in 1983, so 41 years.
Wow.
Yeah, and Marty, which I kind of love, she finished her last movie, Her Cardboard Lover, in March of 1942. Got on a plane, went to Sun Valley. She just left. So it just went. She did take her kids with her on that trip.
Oh, thank God.
And, And Marty was a ski instructor.
Oh.
And from the lore that I got from one of the family members was that Marty was teaching the kids how to ski, or was their ski instructor, and they thought that their mom would really like this guy and brought him home to her.
Mm.
So,
that's
and
cute.
By June, he was already staying in L.A. with her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the papers said that she had house guests, you know, Martin Aroche.
Mm-hmm.
By July, they announced their engagement. In August, they were married.
Wow. That's quick.
Yeah, it was really quick.
Wow. Well, I guess that he must have said that she was the love of his life and he was the love of her life because it just seemed to work out.
Yeah, you know, I think they were just very complimentary of each other. He was very athletic. She was very athletic. Being raised in Montreal, she was a skier, an ice skater.
Mm-hmm.
She loved winter sports in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have been in the 1940 Olympics, but they were canceled because of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like that good a skier. So, and he was like an excellent dancer. So they both took dancing lessons and they were always up on the latest dances. And, you know, Norma would like encourage her friends, like, go dance with Marty. And they're like, I don't know how to dance. And she goes, believe me, he'll make you look good. Like, go dance with Marty.
Uh-huh. And they didn't have any kids together?
No. So They had, there was a young boy who was a friend of Irving Jr.'s.
His uh-huh.
name was Bobby Cox.
Uh-huh.
And they sort of like half adopted him.
No.
So I don't know if he ever lived with them, but they put him through school. They really took care of him. They kind of treated him like their own. And I don't know what the relationship is, how, you know, Norma and Marty met Bobby.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Bobby got polio in 1949, and they took care of him. They put him through college. They did all this stuff for Bobby Cox. And then he just sort of disappeared off the radar. So I'm trying to figure out, like, it's such a generic name. I can't figure out who this kid is and how he fits in the puzzle.
Oh, right. Oh, my God. That's, That's interesting.
Yeah.
It's kind of like something you got to solve and got to find out.
It's these rabbit holes that you find, and you're like, who is this person and why are they connected? It's fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a little frustrating sometimes, but it is a lot of fun.
Mm. So I wonder why they didn't have any kids together. Did he not want any children, or does she just think enough?
I think she had a 7-year-old and a 12-year-old,
mm-hmm.
and she was 42 years old.
Mm.
So... And I know that she, you know, she had some medical issues in the late 30s, and I have a feeling it might be something related to that.
Oh, okay.
So even if she probably wanted to have kids, so, and, you know, she and Marty became jet setters. They were like the true epitome of jet setters, and they were friends with the Vanderbilts, and they were friends with all these very wealthy families,
mm-hmm.
and they just literally spent from when the war ended, like 44, 45, mm-hmm. like 45, 46, they had a chalet in Switzerland. They had a home in Paris. They had Sun Valley. So they basically just spent their time just chasing the snow.
Mm. So, well, that sounds like fun.
I interviewed Gary Cooper's daughter, Maria.
Yes, I love Maria.
Yeah, and Maria said that Marty actually taught her how to ski.
Maria taught it. Maria, you cut off. What'd you say?
Oh, Marty taught her how to ski.
Oh.
Norma's husband, which I thought was a great connection. And I know Gary Cooper, the Coopers, and mm-hmm. Norma and Marty were really tight. And I have lots of pictures of them at parties up until, you know, Cooper passing away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to ask Marie about it. And she said, yeah, you know, they Norma and Marty were always around. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, they were just true jet setters. And they were just really great people. And you know, my ultimate question was like, you know, what was your impression of Norma? And Maria said, you know, something to the gist of, she had a really good time.
Yes.
And I'm like, I like that.
Yes. If you look at her, she just seems like she is just like the life of each party. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
In her movies, I like her early work, like, I know, like, The Divorcee and, there was another.
Wives and
yeah.
Kids
yeah.
And A Free Soul and all those great movies.
Yes. She did a lot of pre-codes.
Yeah,
and
a lot.
And a lot of those pre-codes, you know, some of them are now being released onto DVD and, like, collections and stuff. Like, I have, TCM will release their box sets every now and again. And it'll call the Forbidden Hollywood Collection, which is pre-codes. And I have one of the sets, I think it's Volume 2. It has Night Nurse, it has The Divorcee, and I think it has Marked Woman or something.
Yeah, and one of them has, like, Babyface on it. Like, they've got great
pre-codes. Yes. And when I watched it for the first time, it was so good because you wouldn't expect Norma to get into talkies because, you know, a lot of people's careers were ruined by talking pictures.
Oh, yeah.
But Norma was like, you know what? I'm going to jump into this head first, see what the water's like. And it worked out great for her. And she made, like, such great movies.
Yeah, you know, I always say, Norma's reputation kind of fell into such disrepair. For such a long time because those movies weren't available. Like, they just weren't. And you kind of think about it, it's like we had Barrett's of Wonderful Street and Riptide. And Riptide's a gorgeous movie to look at, but it's not a good movie.
No.
It's chopped to death. And then you have Romeo and Juliet and Marie Antoinette, and then you get into, like, the women and Hideous Delight. So we've never, except for the women, had much to really compare her to.
No.
So when those pre-codes started coming out and people started discovering, like, wow, she's really good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and when you hold her performances into, you know, you watch her in The Women, you watch her in The Divorcee, actresses had completely different ways of acting between 1930 and 39.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, and Norma held on to some of the stuff in the early 30s, but if you watch other movies from 30, 31, you know, Loretta Young and, you know, Barbara Stanwyck, all of them are all, you know, they have a different style.
They do. And it's so interesting to watch their films initially, like, especially when you're watching, like when you're watching Divorcee and The Women, it's like a complete 180 for Norma.
Yeah. And it's like, whoa,
it's like, okay, she's so different in The Women than she's in The Divorcee. Well, of course, because it was a different time period.
Yeah.
Especially like in the early 30s when pre-codes were just like coming out and they were like, this is before the Hays Code. And, you know, I think Hays Code ruins everything, but, you know, that's just me.
Yeah, really did.
So, you know, she made like these groundbreaking movies and she wins an Oscar.
Yeah. And you go back and compare her, you know, to like a Joan Crawford. You watch Joan Crawford in Paid and Possessed and all those ones she made in 30 and 31. And then you compare that to Joan Crawford of The Women, Strange Cargo,
Mildred Pierce.
The Face one.
Oh, A Woman's Face?
A Woman's Face, and you see, like, she has totally turned into a completely different actress.
Mm-hmm. I think that they kind of had to, in a way. You know what I mean? Because, like, times were changing and people's opinions were changing and a lot of different things were changing. So, let's get into your book, which is going to be great because I'm going to be one of the first people to buy it when it premieres. I can't wait. So, my question for you is, how did you discover Norma and how did you get on this journey of writing a book?
Well, with Norma, it's kind of a funny story. When I was 13, I had a social studies teacher named Mrs. Farmer, and I went to school in Santa Monica, so here in L.A. And Mrs. Farmer loved old movies. So she, for our final project for our class, we had to draw a name out of a hat and then write a paper on this actor or actress and why they were important to their time. Like she would bring anything and everything she could back to movies. Like, I would do that too if I was a teacher.
Absolutely.
So I would figure out some way. I think we all would as film geeks.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm a film editor and I do commissions for musicians, and every time that they reach out to me and they give me their track, I say, okay, well, is it okay if I use old movies? And 9 times out of 10 they'd be like, sure, you know, we don't know what you're going to use anyway, so of course. And I'll send it to them. They love it. So of course, you know, I'm going to be the person that inserts Priscilla Lane, Lola Lane, Rosemary Lane, Deanna Durbin, Gloria Jean, Norma Shearer, anybody in there that works well with the track and kind of modernize them, really. So that's what I do.
So, you know, I had to write a paper on her, so I went to the library. There was no books on her. There was the films of Norma Shearer. And then every article I would read was pretty damning. You know, I remember there was an article I read once called Norma Shearer of Nepotism.
Oh.
And I just thought, God, you know, I'm reading on one side of the aisle where they're saying that Norma was the number one box office star in England for the 1930s. For, like, the entire decade, she was the number one box office star in England. Like,
right.
You know, the Brits love her.
Deanna Durbin was too.
Yeah, and then on the other hand, I keep reading, you know, it's like these all-American type girls, and then I keep reading, you know, on the other side, you know, what a terrible actress she was and how she only had her career because of her husband.
I kind of
got fascinated. So I would get on a bus and I would go to Hollywood and I would go to Larry Edmonds. I would go to Collector's Bookstore and I would ask all these old guys who actually had been around in the days of Norma and met her, like, tell me about Norma Shearer. And they just, they loved that this little 13-year-old kid was coming in and asking them. So I started buying photos and it just has grown.
And it would ebb
time, especially, you know, when I was in college and I was broke or, you know, just busy doing other things. And I'd always come across a new friend who would always encourage me to pick it back up again.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
It was almost fate. Like, okay, I need to go back to this.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Norma Shearer to you is like who Deanna Durbin is to me. And I absolutely, like, I've loved her since I was 5 years old. You know, I've wrote to her, you know, when I was 13, got a photo back, you know, that's like the main claim to fame I have. It's like my only connection with her. And I, you know, I loved her so much. And when she died, I was like, my whole world just came to an end. Like, I didn't talk about her for like 3 or 4 years. I didn't watch any of her films. I didn't do anything about her. And ironically, it's like I got really sick in early 2019 and she just starts popping up everywhere. And it's like she's like coming back. And I was like, you know what? I guess this is a sign that she doesn't want me to forget her anymore and like pick her back up and like stuff like that. So I have done my amounts of research, and Gloria Jean was very helpful on the research part because she knew her. So she's like, hey, I've got some information you might want. And I'm like, okay, sounds like a plan. You know, and I have like this Deanna Durbin collection, if you will. Like, I have scrapbooks. I'm trying to buy more photos, you know. But I work at a grocery store, so I have to like budget my money on what I can spend and what I can't buy. But but people definitely spoil me with her because they'll send me photos, they'll send me stuff like of her, and I'll be like, oh my god. So I hope you got a good grade on this report.
Oh, I did. And, you know, it just became an obsession. And then, you know, I started meeting people that knew her. And,
wonderful.
You know, brought to people. And everybody just had lovely things to say about her. So, you know, in, you know, almost 40 years of collecting on her, I've had so many people that are like, you got to write a book, man. You got to write a book.
Yes.
So, you know, and reading Gavin Lambert's book, you know, I never want to say anything bad about another writer, but he really paints her in such a kind of a sad light.
Yes, I've read that.
Yeah, and she wasn't. You know, she was a retired actress. You know, and the crappy thing is, we all get old. You know, it just happens. So, you know, I really want to write a book that just comes from an angle of, you know, she retired rich as hell. She had an Oscar. She had everything that she could do in this business. She didn't need to work anymore. You know, she loved the adulation of it, but I think the work of it and the ageism and all of the nasty things that happened behind the scenes, she was just done with.
Right. You know, and Deanna was as well. By the time, you know, 1948 hits, you know, watching her first films and then comparing it to her last few films, complete 180. Like, you can tell she's not giving her all. She's done. Like, she's over it. Like, you can, there's the vibe that you can just get. And a friend of mine who comes over from work, she's like, I want to watch all of her movies. I'm like, well, you're in luck because I own most of her movies anyway. So we're going through her filmography and we tried watching one of her last films and she just turned to me and she goes, Kate, I don't like this at all. Like, something about her just isn't sitting well with me. And I'm like, oh yeah, it's the vibe you get, right? And she goes, what is going on with her? And I'm like, oh yeah, she's just over it. She's not putting any effort into it. So I think with like all of that, and I think it just gets to a point, I think Norma was getting to that point as well, where scripts were getting less good and they just were becoming the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, she just didn't want to work. So, you know, after Irving died, she signed a 6-picture deal with MGM at $150,000 a picture, so that's $900,000 just there, not accounting what she got from Irving's estate and what she'd made till that point.
Right.
So, and she was really smart with money, so she didn't need to work. So, and the last two pictures she did, because the picture she did after The Women was Escape, and I tell everybody, like, if you want to see where Norma could have gone in the 40s, watch Escape, because she's so good and so subtle and just so amazing in that movie. And then she did We Were Dancing, which had actually been slated for her for like 4 or 5 years. It wasn't like she just decided to make it. That's what Gavin Lambert said, that she decided to dust off this old honey. It was being announced in the papers in like 37, 38 that she was going to make it.
But never got around to it.
On the chart for her to do. And then she did Her Cardboard Lover and was like, I'm out. Like, I don't need to work anymore.
Right. And like you said, she was very good with her money. Like, she had a good bank account. You know, instead of, like, being like a Freddie Bartholomew who owed the studio money, apparently, or, you know, who was around, you know, Cora Sue, who just didn't want to work anymore at all either. It just got to a point where, you know, you get to this issue and you're just like, oh, my God, I got to go and make another movie. I got to have more publicity. Girl, I've got $900,000 in my bank account. Girl, I'm good.
Yeah, like, I'm fine. Like, she and Irving invested their money really well. Like, they were one of the original investors in the Roosevelt Hotel.
Oh, really?
They owned a quarter of the Roosevelt Hotel.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah. So.
That sounds like Benita Granville and Jack Rather making the Disneyland Hotel, so.
Yeah. It's like, are you kidding me? So they own that. They own so much property as I'm getting into it. Like, just huge apartment buildings and office buildings all over the place. So. But, you know, she was fine.
Mm-hmm. Now, take me through, like, her older years, because I know that she kind of... I've read in some places that she was a recluse, and I'm sure that's far from the truth.
Yeah, no, she wasn't at all. So, she retired in 42, and mm-hmm. Marty went into the military, mm-hmm. and she became a military wife. She followed him around for, like, 2 years. Mm-hmm. So, he was stationed in San Francisco. She stayed up there for a while. He was stationed in Phoenix. She stayed out there for a while, and she just would follow Marty and became a military wife, and then she would come here and do charity events and premieres. Like, she was always out.
Oh.
So she was always doing stuff, and then she, you know, every year or so, she would get announced for another movie, mm-hmm. and, like, Zanuck really wanted her for The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, which I think she would have been great in.
Absolutely.
So he really wanted her for that. You know, there was talk about, like, old acquaintance that was never really made official. But mm-hmm. she also knew that even just floating it out there that she was going to make another movie was still going to keep her brand. You know, she was mm-hmm. so aware of her brand. So well into the 50s, she was talking about maybe even doing Broadway.
You know,
so all the gossip columnists were still talking. She never would have done Broadway. Are you kidding? you know, she's a movie actress. Like, she would not have been disciplined enough to do 8 plays a week. Like, hell no.
No. That same with, like, Deanna Durbin. When she was leaving, they said that Broadway came calling and said, hey, we really want you for My Fair Lady. She read it. She loved it. She was getting ready to do it. Like, she was just about ready to sign the contract for it. And her then husband, Charles David, was like, no, I know what this industry does to you. No, ma'am, you will not. No. I am putting my foot down. It's either me or the play. And if you choose the play, I'm out. And so she had just, you know, she had just gotten married anyway. And she's like, do I really want a divorce over this? So she was like, you know, and then she made the comment of, I already had the ticket to Paris in my pocket and I had to leave. So, of course, you know, they were always saying that she was going to make a comeback as well. That never occurred because she's like, I'll read your damn scripts and I'm not going to take them. Are you kidding?
Yeah. Like, absolutely. Well, and with Norma, you know, she knew, you know, she was actually invited to the My Fair Lady premiere right in Q4.
Oh.
And she wrote him a note and asked him, will there be TV cameras there? And he said, yes. And she says, I refuse to ever appear at an event that has TV cameras because they're too harsh.
Mm.
So she was still doing red carpets, but she would always check first to make sure that there wasn't going to be a TV camera there, which I thought was a little shrewd on her part. And, you know, up until, like, 67, 68, like, she was still skiing, she was still traveling the world, she was still all over the place. So at that point, she's, you know, 65, 66,
mm-hmm.
and she's still very socially active. You know, she's really friendly with everybody. She's going to parties, she's going to events. There's so many articles that are, you know, gossip columnists talking about, like, so-and-so had, you know, the Wassermans had a huge party at their home the other night, and the last couple on the dance floor were Norma Shearer and Marty Arochet. Those two can really dance up a storm, and this is, like, 1967.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so far, far from a reckless.
Mm,
she was just a retired actress.
Right, and she just wanted to enjoy her retirement like most people would.
Yeah, and she's loaded.
Absolutely. She's good.
And her name could open doors anywhere. So she was friends with royalty. She was friends with on the jet set.
Whoa.
You know, she could call anybody and they would pick up the phone and take her call.
Absolutely. She'd be like, hey, guess who this is? Who, Norma Shearer? I answered my call. Hey, can I have room service at 12 a.m. in the morning? Sure. What would you like, Ms. Shearer? Well, I like this. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, and so she didn't, you know, what I'm trying to find now is, because she wrote her autobiography and didn't finish it in the 50s, which I've got a copy of, and it's got a lot of problems to it, because it's a little flowery, but I'm able to pull from it quite a bit for the book, which I think is great.
Yes, is it published?
It was never published. She never finished it.
Oh, okay, because she died, right? Yeah.
Well, no, she just emotionally couldn't finish it.
Yeah, that sounds like Deanna Durbin's autobiography. I don't know who has a copy of it now, but she started it because she told Robert Stack about it. And Robert Stack called Gloria and said, hey, Gloria, you know, Deanna's writing a book. She might call you for it. And Deanna literally calls Gloria in 1989, and she says, hey, Gloria, we have history together. Don't repeat it. Click. And that was it. And I said, Gloria, was that all she said? She goes, that was it. I said, well, damn, sis, she could have at least said how the kids, how the grandkids. And she said she didn't want to talk about that. She just said, we had history together. Don't repeat it. Click. And that was it. She hung up.
Yeah, and Norma was oddly the same way. Like, mm-hmm. you know, she made Escape with Mervyn Leroy, uh-huh. and she was very friendly with Mervyn and his wife, mm-hmm. and they're out socially a lot. And mm-hmm. he wrote his autobiography, Take One, mm-hmm. and there's a whole chapter about Escape. Mm-hmm. He never even mentions that she's in it.
Oh, wow.
he doesn't even say, like, I made this picture with Robert Taylor, Norma Shearer, and Conrad Veidt. And then goes on to tell a story about having to replace an actor. He just tells a story about having to replace the actor and bringing in Conrad Veidt. He doesn't even say she's there. And I'm like, wow, that is... And
dick move, man.
Yeah. Well, he probably called her on a day, you know, in the 60s when she was in a mood and was like, hey, I'm writing my autobiography. Can I mention your name? And she was probably like, no.
Probably. Yeah. So, because I thought it was kind of funny because Gloria has a book on herself, and she was kind of like, a couple wrote about her, so a couple interviewed her, did everything, and a lot of the things that Gloria told me are not in this book. And I remember talking to Gloria about it, and I said, and she says, you've probably read the book. And I said, of course. I said, I own it. It's a great book. I said, Gloria, why aren't any of the things you telling me are not in the book? And she says, honey, because there was somebody who was still very much alive. I said, who?
Yeah.
And she goes, her name begins with a D and ends with an A. And I went, oh, God. She goes, if she would have known I would have put all that personal shit in there, oh, girl, she would have sued my ass. And, girl, that is the last person I wanted to be sued by. And I was like, okay.
Yeah. And I think Norma was that way. I mean, Norma really spent the rest of her life, she really got obsessed with it starting, you know, like after the war, preserving Irving's legacy. Mm. And she writes that so many times in so many letters to people and in so many articles that, you know, there's even a letter between her and Irving Jr. that's at the Academy, mm-hmm. where she's talking about, you know, the inheritance to Irving Jr. and how she's preserving Irving Sr.'s legacy. Mm-hmm. So she really was all about, like, preserving that legacy. And, you know, part of preserving that legacy is not talking about anything negative.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if somebody says, I'm writing a book, can I mention you? She doesn't know if it's going to be positive or negative. So, right. On that day, she's probably like, no.
Right. Absolutely. So, when did it end up happening to her? What was her cause of death? When ended up happening?
Around 1978, 79, she never could see very well, which I think is really fascinating. She always had pretty poor vision, even mm-hmm. all the way through the 20s and the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And she wore glasses behind the scenes. Which there were, like, no photos of her wearing glasses. But she couldn't read. She couldn't do anything without glasses.
Mm-hmm.
So I found a picture of her in 1951 at an event where the Producers Guild was giving a Lifetime Achievement Award to Louis B. Mayer, and mm-hmm. she's wearing these fantastic cat-eye glasses.
Whoa.
I'm like, holy shit. Oh, my God, the Holy Grail, a picture of Norma with her glasses on.
Absolutely. Buy it.
But, yeah. But she, so So she had some sort of degenerative eye thing. So her vision was really failing her, and I think that's why she stopped skiing. She stopped driving. She just couldn't see very well. Mm. And then dementia runs in their family, in the Shearer family.
Shit.
So Doug had a version of it. Ethel had a version of it. Their mother had a version of it. So I think it was just ultimately just dementia. Mm-hmm. So Marty put her out at the Motion Picture Country Home to be among her own. Mm. And at the time, he got a lot of flack for it, because it's like, well, how dare you put her out at this, like, you know, poor person's home? Mm-hmm. And he's like, but she's going to be among her own. She doesn't want to be in any sort of convalescent care where people are going to stare at her or do anything inappropriate.
Right.
So she was out there for the last 4 years of her life. And a lot of people went to visit her, and they all have pretty much the same story, just saying, you know, she was pretty gone. You know, she was still very lovely. I had one person that I interviewed that said that she had the strongest grip on an old lady they'd ever seen, and that she would grab your arm and not let you go and literally, like, dig her fingers in your arm. So she just progressively got worse. Well, she just got old. So she, you know, died in 1983. She's 81 years old.
Mm, wow.
So, you know, it's just a pretty natural, you know, it just happens, you know, that's but still, what bugs me about Gavin's book is, like, and then she died so tragically. I'm like, we all get old and die, man. Like, who's got a glamorous death?
Yeah, really. Honestly, like, I know Deanna, because her stepdaughter was like, well, you do know she went into a nursing home. I said, no. And she said, yeah. So I think, because Charles and her were married for like 50 years. Like, they were married for a very long time. And after he died in 99, you know, she lived with, like, I don't want to say with her son, because she lived in the same apartment building as her son, if that makes any sense to you.
No, it totally does.
Okay. So she lived in the same apartment building as her son, but not in the same apartment. So she lived there for kind of like 7-8 years. And Gloria said the last time she heard from her was in 2005. And she said she was just losing her shit. Like, she was just not there. And, you know, I was like, oh, poor baby. And so I think she went into the nursing home later. I'm not sure what year that was. I'll have to talk to Kitty and ask her about it. But they finally had to make the choice to say, well, Charles isn't here and Peter is working and, you know, traveling, because he's in medical research and he's kind of a quote unquote doctor, if you will. So he can't take care of her. And her daughter Jessica is all the way in LA, so she can't do anything. So I guess the best thing for her is to go into a nursing home. So I was like, oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, it makes sense.
I mean, it happens to all of us, you know, something at the end. And very rarely are we 100% until the day we go.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, definitely painting, like, a tragic, tragic picture. You know, and I've read things about Deanna about, like, how tragic. And I'm like, she just retired. She peaced out. Like, I get it.
Yeah. She was like, I'm over it. She was like, she was supposed to make 3 more movies, and that was supposed to be the end of her contract. Those 3 movies were never made. And I think to her relief, she was like, thank God I didn't have to make 3 more movies. Because somebody actually asked me this the other day. They said they had a few questions for me because they know I'm the Deanna person. You know, anything that you probably could ask, I could probably answer, like you with Norma. And they said, what would have happened if she would have went into the 50s? I said, oh, if she would have continued, the 50s would have murdered Deanna. Like, they would have murdered her career. And I'm sure Norma felt the same way after, when she was, like, in the 40s. She was like, this shit sucks, man.
Yeah. You know, she's been doing it since she was 18 years old. You know, she's made umpteen movies. She's mm-hmm. worked her ass off. You know, like, MGM had Pride and Prejudice as early as 1934 mm-hmm. as being a Norma movie. And mm-hmm. they even announced it as being the follow-up to Marie Antoinette. And I can imagine after 6 months on Marie Antoinette and wearing those gowns and those wigs mm-hmm. and the thought of having to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
So she's like, you know, give it to Greer. Like, you know, it's Greer's turn. I can't even bear the thought of putting on another hoop skirt ever again.
Yeah. She was like, give it to Greer Garson. Give it to Ann Rutherford. They'll be good. They'll be great.
Yeah, like, you know, give it to Greer. It's great. And, you know, that's even the whole, like, Mrs. Miniver thing, you know, that Norma turned it down. It was never offered to Norma, but it got brought up in a gossip column around 1946-47 by, like, Hedda Hopper, who was so not a reliable source.
No, oh my God.
And I think it's just perpetuated over the years, and it's like, why not? And there's a great interview with Greer Garson on YouTube, and Greer's like, Norma and I were very good friends, and she was never offered Mrs. Miniver. That was always my movie.
Right? And Ann Hopper was like, clearly not the best person to ever talk to anyway. I mean, I think it was her who called Deanna a bitch in one of the articles I've read, and it was called, like, No Help Needed or something like that. And she's like, Deanna is isolating herself and alienating herself from everybody. And I'm like, oh, God. I was like, Hedda, if you only knew what was going on, like, you could probably understand why she's feeling this way. She's not doing this to be mean or probably rude, but she's doing this because that's the only way she knows how to cope. Like, yeah. Leave the girl alone. Like,
self-preservation.
I know. And I'm like, Hedda, oh, my God. Like...
Well, going through Hedda's articles, like, some of them are fun, but she gets Marty's name wrong. It's Martin. It's, like, you know, every different version of the Marty, Martin, Mary, anything you can do. She gets Norma's kids' names wrong, and they were friends. Like, how do you get your friend, you know, your friend's kids' names wrong?
Right. Like, how do you do that? Like,
yeah.
But Luella Parsons wasn't much better, so.
No, and she got Marty's name wrong a lot, and they would screw up his first and last name all the way through the 50s and into the early 60s and just, like, murder it. And, like, how hard is it to double-check the spelling of this woman's name, you know?
I guess it must have been really difficult since they didn't have Google.
Oh, no, well, you think they just have people on their staff that are like, here, fact-check this at least just for spelling before we send it out. But with Luella, they would just, whatever was on the cuff that day, and then you just send it out.
Right, absolutely. Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Any time. You come up with any more questions or anything, you know, I'd love to do this again sometime.
Absolutely, for sure. So when is your book supposed to be out so we can buy it?
It's probably, I'm shooting for, like, the end of next year. I want to have a rough copy of it done by the end of this year, and I'm being pretty meticulous about it.
Okay.
And then I'm actually going to give it to Suzanne Irving's widow.
Oh.
And have her read it, and just to give like, an opinion on it.
Oh, that'll be great. I'm sure she'd love it.
Yeah, so she could, you know, because she's, you know, none of them are happy about Gavin's book. And the other book, the Lawrence Quirk book, is pretty superficial. It's got a lot of the silent stuff. Mm-hmm. So I want to have a, you know, I've got the outline done. I'm all the way up, I think, through, like, 1924 right now.
Uh-huh.
So, and I just didn't realize how hard, writing a book is really hard.
It is, believe me. I'm trying to write a book on Deanna Durbin is very difficult because her kids are not helpful at all. So it's not like, and Gloria has been dead for 2 years. So it's not like I have a lot of resources to go off of. I do have the Deanna Durbin Society on my side, which they have been very helpful with the information and fact checking and everything. I do have them. But initially it's like, I'm just going to let somebody else, you know, because there's a woman by the name of Melanie Gall, and she's got the thing done. And she's like, I've written a book on Deanna. I was like, great, do it. I'm just doing a photo book on Deanna because I like pictures of her and I want to share the photos I have of her anyway. So that's what I'm doing. And I'm probably going to self-publish that between June or July of this year so people can read it. Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, for sure. I definitely want to get your book and read it so I can appreciate Norma even more.
Yeah, and check out normashear.com.
Will do. Will do.
Got a little biography on there and her complete filmography. So, and Mark Biro and I worked on that together. He did a killer job of putting that together.
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome.
So,
well, thank you again so much, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, I'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
All right, bye.
All right, bye.